None of the organized groups except the highway contractors supported my proposal. The trucking, poultry, and timber interests said they couldn't afford the increases on their big trucks, and they got them reduced. The new car dealers said I wanted to charge their customers too much, and licensing based on value would be an administrative nightmare. I thought their arguments were particularly weak, but the legislature bought them. The highway lobby was represented in the Senate by Knox Nelson, a wily legislator and road contractor himself, who wanted the money but didn't really care how it was raised. In the end, the legislature approved a large increase in revenue from car tags, but within the old weight structure, nearly doubling the price for heavy cars from $19 to $36. I had a decision to make. I could sign the bill into law and have a good road program paid for in an unfair way, or veto it and have no road program at all. I signed the bill. It was the single dumbest mistake I ever made in politics until 1994, when I agreed to ask for a special prosecutor in the Whitewater case when there was not a shred of evidence to justify one. In Arkansas, people's car license fees come due every year on their birthdays, when they have to go to the revenue offices in their local counties to renew them. After the increase went into effect on July 1st, every single day, for a whole year, a new group of people would come into their revenue offices to find their birthday present from me. The price of their car tags had doubled. Many of them were country people who had driven more than 20 miles to the county seat to buy their new tags. Often, they had no checkbooks and had brought only enough cash to pay the previous cost of the tags, so they had to drive all the way back home, get more cash out of the family stash, and come back. When they got back and had to wait in line, as they often did, the only thing they had to look at in the Spartan Revenue offices was a picture of the governor smiling down on them. In late 1978, when I was first elected governor, Hillary Jones had made a prophetic comment to me. He said the Hill people had carried me through three elections, but I would have to get my votes in the cities now. When I asked him why, he replied that I was going to work on schools and economic development, which the state needed, but that anything I did to raise school standards would threaten the rural schools, that I'd never be able to get many new jobs into poor rural areas, and that the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that government employees who weren't in policy-making positions could no longer be replaced for political reasons meant that I couldn't even fire the current state employees in the rural counties and bring our people in. "I'll still do all I can for you," Hillary said, "but it'll never be like it was up here again." As he was about so many things, Hillary was right on target. Over the course of my winning campaigns for governor, I got more and more support from independent and Republican voters in the cities and suburbs, but I never recovered the depth of support I had enjoyed among white rural voters in the 3rd District and much of the rest of the state. Now, on top of all the things I couldn't help, I had shot myself in the foot with the car tag increase, blowing 5 years of hard work among rural Arkansans, and a lot of blue-collar city people, too, with the stroke of a pen. The pattern of good policy and bad politics wasn't confined to legislative matters. I organized the governor's office without a chief of staff, giving different areas of responsibility to Rudy Moore, Steve Smith, and John Danner, a policy analyst from California whose wife, Nancy Pietrafeza, was an old friend of Hillary's. Nancy was working in the administration, too, on education. President Kennedy had organized his White House in a similar way, but his guys all had short hair, boring suits, white shirts, and dark, narrow ties. Rudy, Steve, and John all had beards and were less constrained in their dress code. My conservative critics in the legislature had a field day with them. Eventually, several inter-office conflicts broke out. I decided to make Rudy chief of staff, have Steve oversee a lot of the policy initiatives, and release John Danner and his wife Nancy from their responsibilities. With an inexcusable loss of nerve, I asked Rudy to tell them. He did it, and they quit. Although I tried to talk to them about it later, our relationship never recovered. I doubt that they ever forgave me for not handling it myself, and I don't blame them. They were good people who worked hard and had good ideas. Through inexperience, I had put them in an impossible situation. It was my mistake. I also got into hot water for bringing in a lot of people from out of state to run the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, and its divisions of Social Services and Mental Health, the Department of Education, and the new Department of Energy. They were able and well-intentioned, but they needed more contacts and experience dealing with their constituencies to make the big changes we were seeking. These problems were aggravated by my own lack of experience and my youth. I looked even younger than my 32 years. When I became Attorney General, George Fisher, the talented cartoonist for the Arkansas Gazette, drew me in a baby carriage. When I became governor, he promoted me to a tricycle. It wasn't until I became president that he took me off the tricycle and put me in a pickup truck. And he was a supporter. It should have set off an alarm bell, but it didn't. After a nationwide search, Dr. Robert Young, who had run a successful rural health clinic in West Virginia, was appointed director of the Department of Health. I wanted him to deal with the serious problems of health care access and quality in Arkansas's rural areas. Dr. Young and Orson Berry, director of the Rural Health Office, came up with an innovative plan to establish clinics that required a doctor to be in attendance at least once every 2 weeks, with nurse practitioners and physician's assistants manning them full-time and providing the diagnostic services and treatment for which they were trained. Despite the insufficient number of doctors willing to practice in rural areas, studies showed that most patients preferred a nurse practitioner or physician's assistant because they spent more time with the patients, and a nurse midwife program in Mississippi County had cut the infant mortality rate there in half. Arkansas doctors strongly opposed the plan. Dr. Jim Weber, representing the family physician, said, "We don't believe a little bit of care is better than nothing." Notwithstanding the doctor's opposition, the Carter administration approved a grant funding our plan. We opened 4 rural clinics, started building 3 others, and expanded the Mississippi County Nurse Midwife Program with nurse practitioners. And the work we did won praise across the nation. We tried to work with the physicians whenever we could. I supported appropriations to build an intensive care nursery at the Arkansas Children's Hospital to care for extremely premature and other endangered newborns, and to establish a radiation therapy institute at the University Medical Center to provide better treatment to cancer patients. I appointed Hillary to chair a rural health advisory committee to recommend further improvements and help prioritize the large number of requests for help from rural communities. We worked harder to recruit doctors to rural areas, set up a loan fund to provide up to $150,000 of state money to any doctor who would set up a clinic in a town with 6,000 or fewer people, and allowed family practitioners in small towns to apply for $6,000 a year in income supplements. The doctors strongly supported all these initiatives, which were especially remarkable because the economic downturn in 1980 forced severe cutbacks in the Department of Health's budget. Still, the doctors never forgave Dr. Young or me for not consulting them more and not going more slowly on the rural health clinics. By August 1980, the Arkansas Medical Society was asking for his resignation. When I left office in 1981, some of my initiatives were cut back, illustrating the point that you can have good policy without good politics. But you can't give people good government without both. Energy was a huge issue because of OPEC's steep increases in the price of oil, which raised prices for everything else, too. In this area, we had good policy and better politics, though I still made some powerful enemies. I got the legislature to upgrade the Arkansas Energy Office to a cabinet-level department and attempted to build a broad coalition of ratepayers, utilities, businesses, and government to save ratepayers' money. Give utilities, businesses, and homeowners incentives to promote conservation and help develop new sources of clean energy. I thought we could become more self-sufficient and a national leader in both conservation and alternative fuels. We passed legislation allowing tax deductions for energy conservation and renewable energy expenditures for residential, commercial, and industrial use, and exempted mixed fuels that were at least 10% alcohol from the state gas tax. We provided energy audits to industrial and commercial businesses and gave 50% matching grants to schools, hospitals, and other public institutions for the purchase and installation of energy conservation programs. The federal government provided funds for such initiatives, and we were the first state in the country to get them. When I took office, according to federal government statistics, our energy conservation program was the worst in the country. After a year, we ranked 9th overall and 3rd in industrial conservation. Our efforts at utility regulation were mostly successful, but much more controversial. I wanted the Energy Department to be able to intervene in the Public Service Commission's rate hearings and to be able to get information on and inspect nuclear power facilities. The legislature, prodded by its senior member, Max Howell, who was liberal on education and taxes but close to the utilities, watered down my first request and refused to fund the second. When I persuaded Arkansas Power and Light to offer interest-free conservation loans to its customers and charge the cost of making them to the ratepayers, everyone who understood the issue applauded, knowing it was a far cheaper way of increasing energy availability than building new power plants. Unfortunately, a number of legislators who thought conservation amounted to subversion of the free enterprise system raised so much hell that APNL felt compelled to shelve the program. The utility did continue to support our extensive efforts to weatherize the homes of low-income people, which made them cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter, and cut their utility bills considerably. Alas, even our conservation efforts didn't escape controversy. An investigative reporter discovered that one of the projects we funded was a boondoggle. It was designed to train low-income people to chop wood and distribute it to other poor people to burn in their stoves. The Special Alternative Wood Energy Resources Project had a descriptive acronym, SAR, but a lousy record. It had spent $62,000 to train 6 wood choppers and cut 3 cords of wood. I fired the director and got someone else who fixed the program. But it was the waste that stuck in the public's mind. To most Arkansans, $62,000 was a lot of money. On the regulatory front, we were outgunned on 2 big issues. First, we did our best to stop what was called pancaking by utilities. If they asked for a 10% rate increase and got only 5%, they could collect the 10% while they appealed the decision in court. Meanwhile, they could file for another rate increase and do it all over again, thus pancaking unapproved rates on top of one another. Even if the utilities lost their appeals, which they usually did, the effect of the pancaking was to force ratepayers, including many poor people, to give them massive low-interest loans. It was wrong, but once again the utilities had more swat with the legislature than I did, killing the anti-pancaking bill in committee. Second, I continued to fight with the APNL and its parent, Middle South Utilities, over the plan to make Arkansas ratepayers foot the bill for 35% of the Grand Gulf nuclear plants in Mississippi, while APNL proposed to build 6 coal-fired plants in Arkansas, and demand for electricity in our state was declining so much that APNL was planning to sell electricity from one of its existing plants to out-of-state users. Under the law, utilities were entitled to a profit, euphemistically called a rate of return, on all their expenses. And under the Grand Gulf Plan, Arkansas ratepayers would have to pay for more than a third of the construction cost plus the rate of return, even if they never used any of the power. APNL had no ownership in the plant. It belonged to an independent subsidiary with no ratepayers, and its construction and financing plan had to be approved only by the federal government, which subjected the project to far less than adequate scrutiny. When these facts were published in the Arkansas Gazette, they caused a firestorm of protest. APNL was urged to pull out of Grand Gulf by the chairman of the Public Service Commission. We organized a massive postcard campaign to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, urging them to reverse the Grand Gulf decision and give Arkansas relief. All to no avail. The Grand Gulf arrangement was eventually upheld by the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which had jurisdiction over cases involving federal regulatory agencies. The opinion was written by Judge Robert Bork, my old constitutional law professor. Just as he had been at Yale, he was all for states' rights when it came to restrictions on individual liberty. On the other hand, when big business was involved, he thought the federal government should have the final say and protect business from meddlesome state efforts to look out for the ordinary citizens. In 1987, in testimony I researched and wrote myself for the Senate Judiciary Committee, Bork's decision in the Grand Gulf case was one of the grounds I cited for opposing his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. I worked hard on an energy plan against stiff opposition, but I had made a powerful adversary in APNL, which had offices in most counties, and I wasn't through making enemies. I was upset by what I thought were excessive clear-cutting practices by some of our timber companies, and appointed Steve Smith to head a task force to look into it. Steve was still in his firebrand phase. He scared the timber folks and made them mad. All I wanted the clear cutters to do was reduce the size of their big cuts and leave adequate buffers along roads and streams to reduce soil erosion. My loudest critics claimed I wanted to put every log hauler and mill worker out of business. We got nowhere, and Steve got disgusted and went home to the hills not long afterward. I even made some people mad in my economic development work. That's hard to do. I was determined to broaden the state's efforts beyond the traditional function of recruiting new industries to include the expansion of existing industries and aid to small and minority businesses and farmers in marketing their products at home and abroad. We dramatically increased the activity of our state's European office in Brussels, and I took the first Arkansas trade mission to the Far East, to Taiwan, Japan, and Hong Kong. We became the first state in America to have our own program for handling hazardous waste products approved by the federal government. We were also successful in the traditional work of recruiting new industries with increased investments over previous years of 75% in 1979 and 64% in 1980. How could I make anybody mad with that record? Because I changed the name of the department from the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission to the Department of Economic Development to reflect its new, broader scope of activity. The AIDC, it turned out, was a sacred brand name to many influential business people who had served on the commission and to local Chamber of Commerce directors all over the state who had worked with the agency. They were not satisfied by my appointment of Jim Dyke, a successful Little Rock businessman, to lead the new department. If I hadn't changed his name, I could have done all the same things without the adverse fallout. In 1979 and 1980, I seemed to have an affinity for adverse fallout. I made a similar mistake in education. I appointed Dr. Don Roberts, superintendent of schools in Newport News, Virginia, to be director of education. Don had been an administrator in the Little Rock system a few years earlier, so he knew a lot of the players, and he had a friendly, low-key manner and got along well with most of them. He implemented the reforms I passed in the legislature, plus one of his own, a teacher training program called PET, Program for Effective Teaching. The problem was that to get Don in, I had to ask for the resignation of the department's longtime director, Arch Ford. Arch was a fine gentleman who had devoted decades of dedicated service to Arkansas schoolchildren. It was time for him to retire, though, and this time I didn't make the mistake of letting someone else ask him to go. But I could have handled it better, giving him a big send-off and taking pains to make it look like his idea. I just blew it. In the human services area, we got generally good reviews. We took the sales tax off prescription drugs, a measure especially helpful to seniors, and increased the homestead property tax exemption for them by 2/3. All told, more than 25 bills directly benefiting the elderly were passed, including tougher standards for nursing homes and an expansion of home health care. 1979 was the International Year of the Child. Hillary, who was serving as chair of the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, an organization she had helped to found, took the lead in pushing some meaningful changes, including passing a Uniform Child Custody Act to eliminate custody problems for families moving in and out of our state, reducing the average daily population of our youth service detention centers by 25%, developing better inpatient and community-based treatment for severely disturbed children, and placing 35% more children with special needs in adoptive homes. Finally, I got involved in welfare reform for the first time. The Carter administration named Arkansas one of a handful of states to participate in a workfare experiment, in which able-bodied food stamp recipients were required to register for work in order to keep getting the stamps. The experience sparked my abiding interest in moving toward a more empowering, work-oriented approach to helping poor people, one that I carried with me all the way to the White House and the signing of the Welfare Reform Bill of 1996. As 1980 dawned, I felt good about the governorship and my life. I had made some powerful interests angry, and gripes about the car tags were growing. But I had a long list of progressive legislative and administrative initiatives of which I was very proud. In September, our friends Diane Kincaid and Jim Blair were married in Morris and Ann Henry's backyard, where Hillary and I had had our wedding reception 4 years earlier. I performed the ceremony, as the Arkansas Constitution allows governors to do, and Hillary served as both bridesmaid and best man. The politically correct Blairs referred to her as best person. I couldn't argue with that. Besides being the best, Hillary was pregnant. Very pregnant. We badly wanted to have a child and had been trying for some time without success. In the summer of 1979, we decided to make an appointment with a fertility expert in San Francisco as soon as we got back from a short vacation in Bermuda. But we had a wonderful time. So wonderful, we never made it to San Francisco. Soon after we got home, Hillary found out she was pregnant. She kept working for several months, and we attended Lamaze classes in anticipation of my participating in a natural childbirth. I really enjoyed those classes and the time we spent with the other expectant parents, who were mostly middle-class working people just as excited as we were. A few weeks before her delivery date, Hillary was having a few problems. Her doctor told her she absolutely couldn't travel. We had complete confidence in him and understood that she had to observe his travel ban. Unfortunately, that meant she couldn't go with me to the annual Washington meeting of the National Governors Association, including dinner at the White House with President and Mrs. Carter. I went to the conference, took Carolyn Huber, who had left the Rose Law Firm to run the governor's mansion for us, to the White House dinner, called home every few hours, and returned as soon as I could on the night of February 27th. 15 minutes after I walked into the governor's mansion, Hillary's water broke 3 weeks early. I was nervous as a cat, carrying around my list of Lamaze materials to take to Arkansas Baptist Hospital. The state troopers who worked at the mansion were nervous, too. I asked them to get the bag of ice cubes for Hillary to suck on while I gathered the other stuff. They did. A 9-pound bag, enough to last her through a week of labor. With the trunk loaded with Hillary's ice, the troopers got us to the hospital in no time. Soon after we arrived, we learned that Hillary would have to give birth by cesarean section because the baby was in breech, upside down in the womb. I was told that hospital policy did not permit fathers in the delivery room when an operation was necessary. I pleaded with the hospital administrator to let me go in, saying that I had been to surgeries with mother and that they could cut Hillary open from head to toe and I wouldn't get sick or faint, whereas Hillary was on edge because she had never been a hospital patient in her entire life and she needed me there. They relented. At 11:24 p.m., I held Hillary's hand and looked over the screen blocking her view of the cutting and bleeding to see the doctor lift our baby out of her body. It was the happiest moment of my life, one my own father never knew. Our little girl was a healthy 6 pounds, 1 3/4 ounces, and she cried on cue. While Hillary was in the recovery room, I carried Chelsea out to mother and anyone else who was available to see the world's most wonderful baby. I talked to her and sang to her. I never wanted that night to end. At last I was a father. Despite my love for politics and government and my growing ambitions, I knew then that being a father was the most important job I'd ever have. Thanks to Hillary and Chelsea, it also turned out to be the most rewarding. When we got home from the hospital, Chelsea had a ready-made extended family in the governor's mansion staff, including Carolyn Huber and Eliza Ashley, who had cooked there forever. Liza thought I looked too young to be governor in part because I was thin. She said if I were more stout, I'd look the part, and she was determined to make it happen. She's a great cook, and unfortunately she succeeded. The Rose firm gave Hillary 4 months of parental leave to get Chelsea off to a good start. Because I was the boss, I could control when I went to the office, so I arranged my work to be home a lot in those first few months. Hillary and I talked often about how fortunate we were to have had that critical time to bond with Chelsea. Hillary told me that most other advanced countries provided paid parental leave to all citizens, and we believed that other parents should have the same priceless opportunity we had had. I thought about those first few months with Chelsea in February 1993, when I signed my first bill into law as president, the Family and Medical Leave Act, which allows most American workers 3 months off when a baby is born or a family member is ill. By the time I left office, more than 35 million Americans had taken advantage of the law. People still come up to me, tell me their stories, and thank me for it. After we got Chelsea settled in, I went back to work in a year that would be dominated by politics and disasters. Often the two were indistinguishable. One of the things candidates don't discuss much and voters don't consider carefully in races for governor or president is crisis management. How will the chief executive handle natural or man-made disasters? I had more than my fair share in my first term as governor. The state was deluged in winter ice storms when I took office. I called out the National Guard to get generators to people without electricity, clear rural roads, and pull vehicles out of ditches. In the spring of 1979, we had a string of tornadoes, which required me to ask President Carter to officially declare Arkansas a disaster area, making us eligible for federal funds. We opened disaster assistance centers to help people who'd lost their homes, businesses, and farm crops. We had to do it all over again when the spring of 1980 brought more tornadoes. In the summer of 1980, we had a terrible heat wave that killed more than 100 people and brought the worst drought in 50 years. Senior citizens were most at risk. We kept the senior centers open longer and provided state and federal money to buy electric fans, rent air conditioners, and help pay electric bills. We also got strong support from the Carter administration in the form of low-interest loans for poultry producers who'd lost millions of chickens and farmers whose fields had burned up. The roads were collapsing under the heat, and we had a record number of fires, nearly 800, forcing me to ban outdoor burning. Rural Arkansas was not in a positive frame of mind heading toward the November election. Besides the natural disasters, we had some crises brought on by human accident or design. The damage they caused was more psychological than physical or financial, but it was profound. In the spring of 1979, the Ku Klux Klan and its national director, David Duke, decided to hold a meeting in Little Rock. I was determined to avoid the violence that had erupted between Klansmen and protesters recently during a similar rally in Decatur, Alabama. My public safety director, Tommy Robinson, studied the Decatur situation and put in place stringent security measures to avoid a repeat. We had a lot of state troopers and local police on the ground, with instructions to arrest people at the first sign of disorder. Eventually, six people were arrested, but no one was hurt, thanks largely to the deterrent effect of the large police presence. I felt good about how we handled the Klan situation, and it increased my confidence that we could deal properly with anything that might happen in the future. A year later, something much bigger came up. In the spring of 1980, Fidel Castro deported 120,000 political prisoners and other undesirables, many of them with criminal records or mental problems, to the United States. They sailed to Florida seeking asylum and creating a massive problem for the Carter administration. I knew immediately that the White House might want to send some of the Cubans to Fort Chaffee, a large installation near Fort Smith, because it had been used as a relocation center in the mid-70s for Vietnamese refugees. That relocation was largely successful, and many Vietnamese families were still living in western Arkansas and doing well. When I discussed the issue with Gene Eidenberg, the White House official handling the Cuban issue for the president, I told him the Vietnamese effort had worked well in part because of preliminary screenings in the Philippines and Thailand to weed out those who shouldn't be admitted to the United States in the first place. I suggested he put an aircraft carrier or other large vessel off the coast of Florida and do the same kind of screening. I knew that most of the refugees weren't criminals or crazy, but they were being portrayed that way in the press, and the screening process would build public support for those who did come in. Gene said screening would be pointless because there was no place to send the rejects. Sure there is, I said. We still have a base in Guantanamo, don't we? And there must be a gate in the fence that divides it from Cuba. Take them to Guantanamo, open the door, and march them back into Cuba. Castro was making America look foolish and the president look powerless. Jimmy Carter already had his hands full with inflation and the Iranian hostage crisis. He didn't need this. My proposal seemed to me to be a good way for the president to look strong, turn lemons into lemonade, and pave the way for public acceptance of the refugees who were allowed to stay. When the White House dismissed my suggestion out of hand, I should have known we were in for a long, rough ride. On May 7th, the White House notified me that Fort Chaffee would be used to resettle some of the Cubans. I urged the White House to take strong security precautions and made a statement to the press saying the Cubans were fleeing a communist dictatorship and pledging to do all I can to fulfill whatever responsibilities the president imposes upon Arkansans to facilitate their resettlement. By May 20th, there were nearly 20,000 Cubans at Fort Chaffee. Almost as soon as they arrived, disturbances by young, restless Cubans, tired of being fenced in and uncertain about their future, became a staple of daily life inside the fort. As I have said, Fort Smith was a very conservative community, and most people were none too happy in the first place about the Cubans coming. When reports of the disturbances were publicized, people in Fort Smith and nearby towns became frightened and angry, especially those who lived in the little town of Barling, which borders the fort. As Sheriff Bill Cawthron, who was strong and sensible throughout the crisis, said in an interview, "To say that they, local residents, are scared is an understatement. They are arming themselves to the teeth, and that only makes the situation more volatile." On Monday night, May 26th, a couple of hundred refugees charged the barricades and ran out of the fort through an unguarded gate. At dawn the next morning, primary election day, I called 65 National Guardsmen to Fort Chaffee, flew to Fayetteville with Hillary to vote, then went to the fort where I spent the day talking to people on the ground and at the White House. The commanding officer, Brigadier General James Bulldog Drummond, was an impressive man with a sterling combat record. When I complained that his troops had let the Cubans off base, he told me he couldn't stop them. He had been told by his immediate superior that a federal statute, the Posse Comitatus Law, prohibits the military from exercising law enforcement authority over civilians.
End of Disc 12. Disc 13.
When I complained that his troops had let the Cubans off base, he told me he couldn't stop them. He had been told by his immediate superior that a federal statute, the Posse Comitatus Law, prohibits the military from exercising law enforcement authority over civilians. Apparently, the Army had concluded that the law covered the Cubans, though their legal status was uncertain. They weren't citizens or legal immigrants, but they weren't illegal aliens either. Since they had broken no law, Drummond was told he couldn't keep them at the fort against their will just because the local population detested and feared them. The general said his sole mission was to keep order on the base. I called the president, explained the situation, and demanded that someone be given authority to keep the Cubans on the base. I was afraid people in the area were going to start shooting them. There had been a run on handguns and rifles in every gun store within 50 miles of Chaffee. The next day I again spoke to the president, who said that he was sending more troops and that they would maintain order and keep the Cubans inside the base. Gene Eidenberg told me that the Justice Department was sending the Pentagon a letter saying the military had the legal authority to do so. By the end of the day, I was able to relax a little and to ponder the primary election, in which my only opponent, the old turkey farmer Monroe Schwartzluz, got 31% of the vote, 30 times the vote he had received in the 1978 primary. The rural folks were sending me a message about the car tags. I hoped they had gotten it out of their system, but they hadn't. On the night of June 1st, all hell broke loose. 1,000 Cubans ran out of the fort, right past federal troops, and onto Highway 22, where they began walking toward Barling. Once again, the troops didn't lift a finger to stop them. So I did. The only barrier between the Cubans and several hundred angry and armed Arkansans was composed of state troopers under the command of Captain DeLoyne Causey, a dedicated and cool-headed leader, the National Guardsman, and Sheriff Bill Cawthron's deputies. I had given Causey and the National Guard strict instructions not to let the Cubans pass. I knew what would happen if they did. A bloodbath that would make the Little Rock Central High crisis look like a Sunday afternoon picnic. The Cubans kept coming at our people and began throwing rocks. Finally, Causey told the state police to fire shots over their heads. Only then did they turn around and go back to the fort. When the smoke cleared, 62 people had been injured, 5 of them from the shotgun blasts, and 3 of Fort Chaffee's buildings had been destroyed. But no one was killed or hurt too badly. I flew up to Chaffee as soon as I could to meet with General Drummond. We had a real shouting match. I was outraged that his troops hadn't stopped the Cubans, after the White House had assured me that the Pentagon had received Justice Department approval to do so. The general didn't flinch. He told me he took his orders from a 2-star general in San Antonio, Texas, and no matter what the White House had said to me, his orders hadn't changed. Drummond was a real straight shooter. He was obviously telling the truth. I called Gene Eidenberg and told him what Drummond had said and demanded an explanation. Instead, I got a lecture. Eidenberg said he had been told I was overreacting and grandstanding after my disappointing primary showing. It was obvious that Jean, whom I considered a friend, didn't understand the situation or me as well as I thought he did. I was fit to be tied. I told him that since he obviously didn't have confidence in my judgment, he could make the next decision. You can either come down here and fix this right now tonight, or I'm going to shut the fort down. I'll put National Guardsmen at every entrance, and no one will go in or out without my approval. He was incredulous. You can't do that, he said. It's a federal facility. That may be, I shot back, but it's on a state road, and I control it. It's your decision. Eidenberg flew to Fort Smith on an Air Force plane that night. I picked him up, and before we went to the fort, I took him on a tour of Barling. It was well after midnight, but down every street we drove, at every house, armed residents were on alert, sitting on their lawns, on their porches, and in one case, on the roof. I'll never forget one lady who looked to be in her 70s, sitting stoically in her lawn chair with her shotgun across her lap. Eidenberg was shocked by what he saw. After we finished the tour, he looked at me and said, "I had no idea." After the tour, we met with General Drummond and other federal, state, and local officials for an hour or so. Then we talked to the horde of press people who had gathered. Eidenberg promised that the security problem would be fixed. Later that day, June 2nd, the White House said the Pentagon had received clear instructions to maintain order and keep the Cubans on the base. President Carter also acknowledged that the people of Arkansas had suffered needless anxiety and promised that no more Cubans would be sent to Fort Chaffee. Delays with the screening process seemed to be the root cause of the turmoil, and the people doing the screening made an effort to speed it up. When I went to visit the fort not long afterward, the situation was calmer, and everyone seemed to be in a better frame of mind. While things seemed to be settling down, I was still troubled by what had happened, or hadn't, between May 28th, when Eidenberg told me the Army had been ordered to keep the Cubans from leaving Chaffee, and June 1st, when they let 1,000 of them escape. Either the White House hadn't told me the truth, or the Justice Department was slow in getting its legal opinion to the Pentagon, or someone in the Pentagon had defied a lawful order of the Commander-in-Chief. If that's what happened, it amounted to a serious breach of the Constitution. I'm not sure the whole truth ever came out. As I learned when I got to Washington, after things go wrong, the willingness to take responsibility often vanishes. In August, Hillary and I went to Denver for the summer meeting of the National Governors Association. All the talk was of presidential politics. President Carter seemed to have survived a vigorous challenge to his renomination from Senator Edward Kennedy, but Kennedy had not withdrawn. We had breakfast with the famous criminal lawyer, Edward Bennett Williams, whom Hillary had known for years and who had wanted her to come to work for him after law school. Williams was strongly for Kennedy and believed he'd have a better chance to defeat Ronald Reagan in the fall campaign because the president was bedeviled by a bad economy and the 10-month-long captivity of our hostages in Iran. I disagreed with him on the politics and the merits. Carter had done a lot of good things as president, wasn't responsible for the OPEC price increases that had fueled the inflation, and had few good options for dealing with the hostage crisis. Besides, despite the problems with the Cubans, the Carter White House had been good to Arkansas, giving financial aid and support to our reform efforts in education, energy, health, and economic development. I had also been given remarkable access to the White House for both business and pleasure. In the latter category, the best visit was when I took Mother to hear Willie Nelson sing on the south lawn of the White House at a picnic the president hosted for NASCAR. After the event, Mother and I accompanied Nelson and the President's son, Chip, to the Hay Adams Hotel across Lafayette Square from the White House, where Willie sat at the piano and sang for us until 2 in the morning. For all those reasons, I was feeling good about my relationship with the White House as the National Governors Association meeting began. The Democratic governors and their Republican counterparts held separate meetings. I had been elected vice chairman of the Democratic governors at the winter meeting, thanks to my nomination by Governor Jim Hunt of North Carolina, who would become one of my closest friends among the governors and an ally in the fight for education reform all the way through the White House years. Bob Strauss, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, asked me to get the Democratic Governors Association to endorse President Carter over Senator Kennedy. After a quick canvass of the governors present, I told Strauss the vote would be 20-4 for Carter. We had a civilized debate with Strauss speaking for the president and Governor Hugh Carey of New York arguing for Kennedy. After the 20-4 vote, Strauss and I spoke briefly to the press, touting the endorsement as a show of confidence in and political boost for President Carter at a time when he needed it. About 15 minutes later, I was told the White House was trying to reach me on the phone. Apparently, the president wanted to thank me for helping line up the governor's support. Appearances can be deceiving. What the president wanted to tell me was that the weather was about to turn cold in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where the rest of the Cubans were being housed, because those forts weren't insulated from the winter weather. He said it would be necessary to move the refugees. Then came the kicker. Now that the security problems were solved at Fort Chaffee, they would be moved there. I responded, "Mr. President, you promised that no more refugees would be sent to Arkansas. Send them to a fort in some warm place out west you're not going to win in November anyway." The president replied that he had considered that, but couldn't do it because it would cost $10 million to outfit a facility out west. I said, "Mr. President, your word to the people of Arkansas is worth $10 million. He disagreed, and we ended the conversation. Now that I've been president, I have some idea of the pressures Jimmy Carter was under. He was dealing with both rampant inflation and a stagnant economy. The American hostages in Iran had been held by the Ayatollah Khomeini for almost a year. The Cubans weren't rioting anymore, so they were the least of his problems. Pennsylvania and Wisconsin had both voted for him in 1976, and they had more electoral votes than Arkansas, which he had won with almost two-thirds of the vote. I was still more than 20 points ahead of my opponent, Frank White, in the polls, so how could I be hurt? At the time, I saw it differently. I knew the president would be hurt badly by breaking his commitment to Arkansas. Whether or not the forts in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania had to be closed for weather or for political reasons, sending the remaining Cubans to the one place he had promised not to in order to save $10 million was nuts. I called Rudy Moore and my campaign chairman, Dick Hurgit, to see what they thought I should do. Dick said I should fly directly to Washington to see the president. If I couldn't change his mind, I should talk to the press outside the White House and withdraw my support for his re-election. But I couldn't do that for two reasons. First, I didn't want to look like a modern version of Orville Faubus and other Southern governors who resisted federal authority in the Civil Rights years. Second, I didn't want to do anything to help Ronald Reagan beat Carter. Reagan was running a great campaign, with a big head of steam, fueled by the hostages, the bad economy, and the intense support of right-wing groups outraged about everything from abortion to Carter's turning the Panama Canal over to Panama. Gene Eidenberg asked me not to announce the relocation until he could come to Arkansas and put the best face on it. The story leaked anyway, and Gene's visit to Arkansas did little to help. He made a convincing case that there would be no further security problems, but he couldn't deny that the president was breaking a clear commitment to the state that had been more supportive of him than any other outside his native Georgia. I won a larger role in controlling the security arrangements and made some improvements, but I was still the president's man in Arkansas, who had failed to hold him to his word. I returned home from Denver to a very volatile political situation. My opponent in the general election, Frank White, was gaining ground. White was a big man with a booming voice and a bombastic style that belied his background as a graduate of the Naval Academy, savings and loan executive, and former director of the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission under Governor Pryor. He had strong support from all the interest groups I'd taken on, including utility, poultry, trucking and timber companies, and the medical associations. He was a born-again Christian with the strong backing of the state chapter of the Moral Majority and other conservative activists. And he had the pulse of the country people and blue-collar workers upset about the car tags. He also had the advantage of a generally disgruntled mood due to the economy and the drought. When the bad economy led state revenues to decline below projections, I was forced to lower state spending to balance the budget, including education cuts that reduced the second year's $1,200 pay raise for teachers to about $900. Many teachers didn't care about the state's budget problems. They had been promised $1,200 for 2 years, and they wanted the second installment. When it didn't come, the intensity of their support for me faded considerably. Back in April, Hillary and I had seen Frank White at an event, and I told her that no matter what the poll said, he was starting with 45% of the vote. I had made that many people mad. After the announcement that all the refugees would be housed at Fort Chaffee, White had his mantra for the election: Cubans and car tags. That's all he talked about for the rest of the campaign. I campaigned hard in August, but without much success. At factory gates, workers changing shifts said they wouldn't vote for me because I had made their economic woes worse and betrayed them by raising the car tags. Once, while campaigning in Fort Smith near the bridge to Oklahoma, when I asked a man for his support, he gave a more graphic version of the answer I'd heard hundreds of times. "You raise my car tags. I wouldn't vote for you if you were the only SOB on the ballot." He was angry and red in the face. In exasperation, I pointed over the bridge to Oklahoma and said, "Look over there. If you lived in Oklahoma, your car tags would be more than twice as expensive as they are now." Suddenly, all the red drained out of his face. He smiled, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, "See, kid, you just don't get it. That's one reason I live on this side of the border." At the end of August, I went to the Democratic National Convention with the Arkansas delegation. Senator Kennedy was still in the race, though he was clearly going to lose. I had some good friends working for Kennedy who wanted me to encourage him to withdraw before the balloting and make a generous speech supporting Carter. I liked Kennedy and thought it was best for him to be gracious so that he wouldn't be blamed if Carter lost. The blood between the two candidates was bad, but my friends thought I might be able to persuade him. I went to the senator's hotel suite and gave it my best shot. Kennedy ultimately did withdraw and endorse the president, though when they appeared on the platform together, he didn't do a very good job of faking an enthusiasm he clearly didn't feel. By convention time, I was the chairman of the Democratic Governors Association and was invited to give a 5-minute address. National conventions are noisy and chaotic. The delegates normally listen only to the keynote address and the presidential and vice presidential acceptance speeches. If you're not giving one of those three, your only chance of being heard over the constant din of floor talk is to be compelling and quick. I tried to explain the painful, profoundly different economic situation we were experiencing and to argue that the Democratic Party had to change to meet the challenge. Ever since World War II, Democrats had taken America's prosperity for granted. Their priorities were extending its benefits to more and more people and fighting for social justice. Now we had to deal with inflation and unemployment, big government deficits, and the loss of our competitive edge. Our failure to do so had driven more people to support Republicans or to join the growing cadre of alienated non-voters. It was a good speech that took less than the allotted 5 minutes, but nobody paid much attention to it. President Carter left the convention with all the problems he had when he started, and without the boost a genuinely enthusiastic United Party usually gives its nominee. I returned to Arkansas determined to try to salvage my own campaign. It kept getting worse. On September 19th, I was home in Hot Springs after a long day of politics when the commander of the Strategic Air Command called me to say that there had been an explosion in a Titan II missile silo near Damascus, Arkansas, about 40 miles northwest of Little Rock. The story was unbelievable. An Air Force mechanic was repairing the missile when he dropped his 3-pound wrench. It fell 70 feet to the bottom of the silo, bounced up, and punctured the tank full of rocket fuel. When the highly toxic fuel mixed with the air, it caused a fire, then a huge explosion that blew the 740-ton concrete top off the silo, killed the mechanic, and injured 20 other Air Force personnel who were near the opening. The explosion also destroyed the missile and catapulted its nuclear warhead into the cow pasture where the silo was located. I was assured the warhead wouldn't detonate, that no radioactive material would be released, and that the military would remove it safely. At least my state wasn't going to be incinerated by Arkansas's latest brush with bad luck. I was beginning to feel snake-bit, but tried to make the best of the situation. I had instructed my new director of public safety, Sam Tatum, to work out an emergency evacuation plan with federal officials in case something went wrong with one of the 17 remaining Titan II missiles. After all the other things we'd been through, now Arkansas had the world's only cow pasture with its very own nuclear warhead. A few days after the incident, Vice President Mondale came to our state Democratic convention in Hot Springs. When I asked him to make sure the military cooperated with us on a new emergency plan for the missiles, he picked up the phone and called Harold Brown, the Secretary of Defense. His first words were, "Damn it, Harold, I know I asked you to do something to get the Cuban problem off Arkansas's mind, but this is a little extreme." Contrary to his restrained public demeanor, Mondale had a great sense of humor. He knew we were both tanking, and he still made it funny. The last few weeks of the campaign were dominated by a new phenomenon in Arkansas politics: completely negative television ads. There was a tough one on the car tags, but White's most effective campaign ad showed rioting Cubans with a strong voiceover telling viewers that the governors of Pennsylvania and Wisconsin cared about their people and they got rid of the Cubans, but I cared more about Jimmy Carter than the people of Arkansas. And now we've got them all. When Hillary and I first saw it, we thought it was so outrageous that no one would believe it. A poll taken right before the ad started running had shown that 60% of the people thought I'd done a good job at Fort Chaffee, while 3% thought I'd been too tough, and 20%, the hardcore right, too weak. I could have satisfied them only by shooting every refugee that left the fort. We were wrong about the ads. They were working. In Fort Smith, local officials, including Sheriff Bill Cawthron and prosecuting attorney Ron Fields, strongly defended me, saying I had done a good job and had taken risks to protect the people around the fort. As we all know now, a press conference will not counter the effect of a powerful negative ad. I was sinking in the quicksand of Cubans and car tags. Several days before the election, Hillary called Dick Morris, whom I had replaced with Peter Hart, because my people hated dealing with Dick's abrasive personality. She asked him to do a poll to see if there was anything we could do to pull it out. To his credit, Dick did the poll, and with characteristic bluntness, said that I would probably lose. He made a couple of suggestions for ads, which we followed, but as he predicted, it was too little, too late. On Election Day, November 4th, Jimmy Carter and I got 48% of Arkansas's vote, down from his 65% in 1976 and my 63% in 1978. However, we lost in very different ways. The president carried 50 of the 75 counties, holding on to the Democratic strongholds where the Cuban issue cut into but didn't eliminate his margin of victory, and getting annihilated in the more conservative Republican areas in western Arkansas, where there was a high turnout fueled by voters' anger over his broken pledge on the Cubans and by Reagan's alliance with Christian fundamentalists and their opposition to abortion and the Panama Canal treaties. Arkansas still hadn't gone over to the Republicans. Carter's 48% was 7 points better than his national percentage. If it hadn't been for the broken pledge, he would have carried the state. By contrast, I carried only 24 counties, including those with heavy black populations and a few where there was more support for or less opposition to the highway program. I lost all 11 counties in Democratic Northeast Arkansas, almost all the rural counties in the 3rd District, and several in South Arkansas. I had been killed by the car tags. The main effect of the Cuban ad was to take away voters who had been supporting me despite their reservations. Public approval of my performance on the Cuban issue kept my poll ratings higher than they would have been in the face of the car tags, the interest group's opposition, and the dour economic situation. What happened to me in 1980 was strikingly similar to what happened to President George H.W. Bush in 1992. The Gulf War kept his poll numbers high, but underneath there was a lot of discontent. When people decided they weren't going to vote for him on the war issue, I moved ahead. Frank White used the Cuban ad to do the same thing to me. In 1980, I ran better than President Carter in the Republican areas in western Arkansas, where there was more direct knowledge of how I had handled the Cuban situation. In Fort Smith and Sebastian County, I actually led the Democratic ticket because of Fort Chaffee. Carter got 28%. Senator Bumpers, who had practiced law there for more than 20 years, but who had committed the unpardonable sin of voting to give away the Panama Canal, got 30%. I got 33%. That's how bad it was. On election night, I was in such bad shape, I didn't think I could bear to face the press. Hillary went down to the headquarters, thanked the workers, and invited them to the governor's mansion the next day. After a fitful night's sleep, Hillary, Chelsea, and I met with a couple of hundred of our diehard supporters on the back lawn of the mansion. I gave them the best speech I could, thanking them for all they'd done, telling them to be proud of all we'd accomplished, and offering my cooperation to Frank White. It was a pretty upbeat talk considering the circumstances. Inside, I was full of self-pity and anger, mostly at myself. And I was filled with regret that I would no longer be able to do the work I loved so much. I expressed the regret, but kept the whining and anger to myself. At that moment, there didn't seem to be much future for me in politics. I was the first Arkansas governor in a quarter of a century denied a second 2-year term, and probably the youngest ex-governor in American history. John McClellan's warning about the governor's office being a graveyard seemed prophetic. But since I had dug my own grave, the only sensible thing to do seemed to be to start climbing out. On Thursday, Hillary and I found a new home. It was a pretty wooden house built in 1911 on Midland Avenue in the Hillcrest area of Little Rock, not too far from where we'd lived before moving into the governor's mansion. I called Betsy Wright and asked her if she'd come and help me get my files organized before I left office. To my joy, she agreed. She moved into the governor's mansion and worked every day with my friend State Representative Gloria Cabe, who had also been defeated for re-election after supporting all my programs. My remaining 2 months in office were tough on my staff. They needed to find jobs. The usual route out of politics is through one of the big companies that do a lot of business with state government, but we had angered all of them. Rudy Moore did a good job trying to help everyone and make sure we cleared up all outstanding public business before we turned the office over to Frank White. He and my scheduler, Randy White, also reminded me in my periods of self-absorption that I needed to show more concern for my staff and their future welfare. Most of them had no savings to sustain a long job hunt. Several had young children. And many had worked only for the state, including a number of people who had been with me in the Attorney General's office. Though I really liked the people who had worked for me and felt grateful to them, I'm afraid I didn't demonstrate that as clearly as I should have on many of the days after I lost. Hillary was especially good to me in that awful period, balancing love and sympathy with an uncanny knack for keeping me focused on the present and the future. The fact that Chelsea didn't have a clue that anything bad had happened helped me realize that it was not the end of the world. I got great calls of encouragement from Ted Kennedy, who said I'd be back, and Walter Mondale, who showed extraordinary good humor in the face of his own disappointing defeat. I even went to the White House to say goodbye to President Carter and thank him for all the good things his administration had done to help Arkansans. I was still upset about his broken pledge and how it contributed to my defeat and led to his loss in Arkansas, but I felt history would be kinder to him because of his energy and environmental policies, especially the establishment of the massive Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska and his accomplishments in foreign policy, the Camp David Agreement between Israel and Egypt, the Panama Canal treaties, and the elevation of the human rights issue. Like the rest of the employees of the governor's office, I had to find a job, too. I got several interesting offers or inquiries from out of state. My friend John Y. Brown, governor of Kentucky, who had made a fortune with Kentucky Fried Chicken, asked if I'd be interested in applying for the presidency of the University of Louisville. In typical John Y. short speak, he made the pitch. Good school, nice house, great basketball team. California Governor Jerry Brown told me his chief of staff, Gray Davis, himself a future governor, was leaving and asked me to replace him. He said that he couldn't believe I'd been thrown out over car tags, that California was a place full of people who had moved there from other states and I'd fit right in, and that he'd guarantee my ability to influence policy in areas I cared about. I was approached about taking over the World Wildlife Fund, a Washington-based conservation group, which did work I admired. Norman Lear, producer of some of the most successful television shows in history, including All in the Family, asked me to become head of the People for the American Way, a liberal group established to counter conservative assaults on First Amendment freedoms. And several people asked me to run for chairman of the Democratic National Committee against Charles Manette, a successful Los Angeles lawyer with Iowa roots. The only job offer I got in Arkansas was from Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings, a fine law firm, which asked me to become of counsel for $60,000 a year, almost twice what I'd made as governor. I took a hard look at the Democratic committee job because I loved politics and thought I understood what needed to be done. In the end, I decided it wasn't right for me. Besides, Chuck Manette wanted it badly and probably already had the votes to win before I got interested. I discussed it with Mickey Cantor, a partner of Manette's whom I'd gotten to know when he served with Hillary on the board of the Legal Services Corporation. I liked Mickey a lot and trusted his judgment. He said if I wanted another chance at elected office, I shouldn't try for the party job. He also advised against becoming Jerry Brown's chief of staff. The other out-of-state jobs had some appeal to me, especially the one at the World Wildlife Fund, but I knew they didn't make sense. I wasn't ready to give up on Arkansas or myself, so I accepted the offer from Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings. Almost immediately after I lost, and for months afterward, I asked everybody I knew why they thought it had happened. Some of the answers, beyond Cubans, car tags, and making all the interest groups angry at the same time, surprised me. Jimmy Red Jones, whom I had appointed Adjutant General of the Arkansas National Guard after he had had a long career as a state auditor, said I had alienated the voters with too many young beards and out-of-staters in important positions. He also thought Hillary's decision to keep her maiden name had hurt. It might be all right for a lawyer, but not for a first lady. Wally DeRoque, who had been my chairman in 1976 and 1978, said I got so caught up in being governor that I stopped thinking about everything else. He told me that after I became governor, I never asked him about his children again. In harsher language, my friend George Daniel, who owned the hardware store in Marshall up in the hills, said the same thing. Bill, the people thought you were an asshole. Rudy Moore told me that I had complained a lot about how much trouble I was in, but never seemed to really focus on my political problems hard and long enough to figure out what to do about them. Mac McClarty, my oldest friend, who knew me like the back of his hand, said he thought I was preoccupied all year by the arrival of Chelsea. He said that I had always been saddened by the fact that I never knew my own father, that I really wanted to focus on being Chelsea's father, except when something like the Cuban crisis tore me away, and that I just didn't have my heart in the campaign. After I was out of office a few months, it became clear to me that all these explanations had some validity. By that time, more than 100 people had come up to me and said they'd voted against me to send a message, but wouldn't have done it if they'd known I was going to lose. I thought of so many things I could have done if I'd had my head on straight. And it became painfully clear that thousands of people thought I'd gotten too big for my britches, too obsessed with what I wanted to do, and too oblivious to what they wanted me to do. The protest vote was there all right, but it didn't make the difference. The post-election polls showed that 12% of the voters said they'd supported me in 1978, but voted the other way in 1980 because of the car tags. 6% of my former supporters said it was because of the Cubans. With all my other problems and mistakes, if I had been free of either of these two issues, I would have won. But if I hadn't been defeated, I probably never would have become president. It was a near-death experience, but an invaluable one, forcing me to be more sensitive to the political problems inherent in progressive politics. The system can absorb only so much change at once. No one can beat all the entrenched interests at the same time. And if people think you've stopped listening, you're sunk. On my last day in the governor's office, after taking a picture of 10-month-old Chelsea sitting in my chair holding the telephone, I went up to the legislature to give my farewell address. I recounted the progress we'd made, thanked the legislators for their support, and pointed out that we still had America's second lowest tax burden, and that sooner or later, we would have to find a politically acceptable way to broaden our revenue base to make the most of our potential. Then I walked out of the Capitol and into private life, a fish out of water. Chapter 22. Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings was, by Arkansas standards, a large firm with a fine reputation and a varied practice. The support staff were able and friendly and went out of their way to help me settle in and make me feel at home. The firm also allowed me to bring my secretary, Barbara Kearns, who had been with me for 4 years by then and knew all my family, friends, and supporters. It even provided Betsy Wright office space so that she could keep working on my files and, as it turned out, plan the next campaign. I did some legal work and brought in a couple of modest clients, but I'm sure the lifeline the firm threw me didn't make it any money. All the firm really got out of it was my everlasting gratitude and some legal business defending me when I became president. Though I missed being governor and the excitement of politics, I enjoyed the more normal pace of my life, coming home at a reasonable hour, being with Hillary as we watched Chelsea grow into her life, going out to dinner with friends, and getting to know our neighbors, especially the older couple who lived directly across the street, Sarge and Louise Lozano. They adored Chelsea and were always there to help out. I resolved to stay away from public speaking for several months, with one exception. In February, I drove to Brinkley, about an hour east of Little Rock on the interstate, to speak at the Lions Club banquet. The area had voted for me in 1980, and my strongest supporters there all urged me to come. They said it would lift my spirits to be with folks who were still supporters, and it did. After the dinner, I went to a reception at the home of my county leaders Don and Betty Fuller, where I was gratified and a little surprised to meet people who actually wanted me to be governor again. Back in Little Rock, most people were still trying to get on good terms with the new governor. One man whom I'd appointed to a position in state government and who wanted to stay on under Governor White actually crossed the street in downtown Little Rock one day when he saw me walking toward him. He was afraid to be seen shaking hands with me in broad daylight. While I was grateful for the kindness of my friends in Brinkley, I didn't go out speaking again in Arkansas for several months. Frank White was beginning to make mistakes and lose some legislative battles, and I didn't want to get in his way. He kept his campaign pledge to pass bills changing the name of the Economic Development Department back to the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission and abolishing the Department of Energy. But when he tried to abolish the rural health clinics Hillary and I had established, large numbers of people who depended on them showed up to protest. His bill was defeated, and he had to be content with stopping the building of more clinics that would have served others who really needed them. When the governor introduced a bill to roll back the car tag increase, the director of the highway department, Henry Gray, the highway commissioners, and the road builders put up a strong resistance. They were building and repairing roads and making money. A lot of legislators listened to them, because their constituents liked the road work even if they had resisted paying for it. In the end, White got a modest rollback in the fees, but most of the money stayed in the program. The governor's biggest legislative problem arose, ironically, out of a bill he passed. The so-called Creation Science Bill required that every Arkansas school that taught the theory of evolution had to spend an equal amount of time teaching a theory of creation consistent with the Bible, that humans did not evolve out of other species around 100,000 years ago, but instead were created by God as a separate species a few thousand years ago.